tsunami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 474 of the Toonami Escape podcast. I'm C. Kohler, and with me tonight is Seda.
Hello.
And Crocodile.
Evening.
Well, guys, welcome back to another week of Toonami. We're going to start off the news with a bit of something worth mentioning, which is that the founder of Cartoon Network and many a media corporation, Ted Turner, has passed away at the age of 87.
Yeah, I guess I would say going over his entire life is beyond purview of his podcast. But as you said, he was reason Cartoon Network exists, and by extension, the reason Toonami and Adult Swim exists, and by extension, the reason why this podcast exists. So, and obviously, he's made contributions to the world of sports, in wrestling, and he's a major figure of Atlanta and by extension, the state of Georgia. Like, again, his entire life beyond the purview of this podcast, but I think we owe him respect and recognition just for, of course, doing so much, but of course, doing so much within the context of what we're doing here. And so to him, I say, and I think we all say, rest in peace.
Yeah. I did see that Adult Swim did do a special tribute title card. Like, that, you know how they do those things from time to time where they'll just put up a picture. They did one for him.
Yeah, I was wondering if they're going to do that for this week's Toonami, if Tom's going to say something. It might have been too, may have not had a chance to get get him in the booth to record anything, or I don't know, but I expect something, but I didn't see anything, but maybe next week or maybe not. But you said Adult Swim proper did something, so that's good to see.
Yeah. So yeah, it's important to mention that. I guess one other thing I didn't have in my notes here that I also wanted to mention was this is not for Toonami, at least not yet. And that is that they did release a new trailer for the upcoming Science Saru production of The Ghost in the Shell. It looks fantastic. It's basically unlike the Ghost in the Shell movie and the standalone complex and other reboots that have come out since then, this one is very, very, very faithful to the original manga, both in the way it's animated and the way that it's drawn, but also in the tone of the manga. I do remember, I didn't read much of it, but I did read a little bit of it back in the day. And yeah, this is it's kind of neat because one thing that really stands out to me about this is that, it might be flippant to say this, but you don't see this very often where someone is where they're deliberately trying to make it look like the source material of its era. When you look at this animation, it looks fantastic, but it also looks very much like the animation from the late 80s.
Yeah, it's very much not modernized. I mean, it's obviously modernly made. Science Saru, you can tell their techniques. We've obviously seen their work in Dandadan and other series. But it's very much, as you're saying, evoking a classic 80s, 90s anime, but just extremely high production values and, all the modern techniques that the 2020s offer animators nowadays.
Yeah, if it wasn't in high definition and you were standing a little further away from your television, you might just think this was a show that was made back in the 80s in that way. And has that look. And I just think that's a neat idea that if this turns out to be a success, I think this is a neat idea. I think there's opportunities to do more of this in the future.
Well, there are plenty of really iconic IPs from the 80s and 90s that are still relevant today that if someone was willing to fund it and think it could, make its money back or whatnot, could find an audience and, be a pretty big success. It depends on, if they can get that resource together. I will ask, is this series is it in Netflix jail or anything announced for that regard for Western distribution?
I think it is, from what I understand, I think it's Amazon Prime, I think.
Oh. So that's probably, I think it's probably a jail of its own, right? I don't think anything
I think
Amazon
so.
Has ever gotten out of that. So,
I'm not sure. We've never had a conversation about a show that was once on Amazon and now on Toonami that I can remember. So probably not, but yeah.
Okay. I was just curious if it was like had any chance to come to Toonami or not.
We never know. Like I said, we've seen some things recently that were like, we never thought could come to Toonami and did. So I wanted to throw it out there that this is coming and that Ghost in the Shell is certainly a franchise that has appeared on Toonami in the past. So you never know, right?
It is Amazon to confirm.
It is.
Okay. It is worldwide. So,
okay.
It's like, I mean, nothing's gotten out of Netflix jail. I don't think anything's gotten out of Amazon jail. Things have gotten out of Hulu jail, with Bleach being a big example. So like, you know, not all jails are unimpenetrable.
Not all jails are. So some jails can be escaped from. you can escape jail.
Right. So as far as I know, Amazon jail is still, no one's escaped there yet.
No, we need to help break them out. Okay. And that's all I had for news this week. So let's go into the block rundown then. It's the favorite part of the show. And let's talk about Rooster Fighter. Something's broken. Rooster Fighter Episode 9, Gone to the Birds. So we pick up where we left off. They've arrived in that city where the big things are attacking, and they, you know, she's got that octopus wrapped up, Elizabeth does, and we learn that this is an old man octopus, and that some sort of parasite ends up coming out of his head, and they kill it, and then once that thing is killed, they realize he's better, that was what was controlling him. So she was right. She was right to save him, because he isn't truly evil. It's just some of these demons are being controlled.
And he, of course, gave them a ton of information, too, so.
Yeah. He did say that that they're searching, that these devils are searching.
What they say is that Elizabeth even asks, like, what's the devil's plan? They just have you going out and destroying the city? And they're like, actually, we're just blowing off steam. But I overheard them searching for something. So, yeah, all the city-destroying stuff is just, yeah, nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, they're still under the control of the devils in that regard. So not just like destroying stuff for shits and giggles. If they were not under mind control, they wouldn't
I think that's what they're saying, isn't it? That what they're saying is that, like,
well, it seems like it's kind of loose. It's just like they're under mind control. They're under mind control. And it's just like, because they're under mind control, they have them go destroy the city just for fun, but they wouldn't do that if they weren't.
Right. Like Moria would never do this if it wasn't being controlled. And it's this same with Old Man Octopus. They would never just randomly destroy a city. So city structure might not be for whatever plot the devils are, you know, enacting, but they still, these monsters wouldn't be doing that if they were not under devil's control.
I took it a different way. I think you guys are right. But the way I took it was that the monsters, when they have the parasite in them, the parasites were bored. And that's why they were out attacking things. But I could be mistaken.
The main thing that matters is, I remember last week we were actually wondering, like, what are they trying to do? Like, they're just trying to destroy stuff. And apparently the answer is, well, not, that's not their main goal. You know, that's just a side effect. So.
My next note here is that Pyoko wants to go also. So there's a bit in this episode about Pyoko feeling left out from the battles. She's, you know, she wants to contribute. And she really hasn't had an opportunity to. And then we get a fun scene where Elizabeth says, well, hey, I'll be right back. I got to go do something. And then she kind of heads off. And then we see this like helicopter come landing. And then she's reunited with her papa, her human papa, who can speak fluent Chickenese. Like they literally say Chickenese. Like it's a language. He speaks chicken.
Yeah, it's funny that instead of Elizabeth trying to use the smartphone, like she's been doing to communicate with other humans, her father or her owner, or whatever you want to frame it, just knows how to speak chicken, and they just talk back and forth. It's pretty funny.
Yeah. The more you think about this, like, what other pet do you, like, learn your pet's language to try to speak?
I mean, to be fair, obviously these chickens are way smarter than the average chicken. Like, if this was a chicken that you could actually hold a conversation about with the, like, the, you know, philosophy and the meaning of life and whatnot, there would be incentive to actually learn that sort of language.
It's more like an adopted daughter.
Right, but I'd also think that this is all a joke, because, like,
for sure,
I think all the animals in this world can just, I mean, every animal we've seen so far can just speak and has conversations. They don't speak, like, to humans, but...
No, they can't speak to humans. They can understand humans to some degree, but they can't speak to humans directly, right. Which is a lot.
Like, thinking back to, like, the cats from that earlier episode, like, they have, like, general human-level intelligence, right?
Oh,
they're
right.
Anthropomorphic. So, like, sure. That's – I think we're supposed to, like, kind of just be like, oh, whatever, you know. It would be boring if they were all just animals, right? So, like, they can talk and they can have conversations and
right.
think
there'd
about
be no
things.
Plot, right.
Right. But I think – this is the show being silly about it, being like,
don't think
oh,
about it too much.
Yeah, that, like, the human can speak it too. It's like, yeah, that's not really a thing. It's just like, it's a thing, but, like, you're not really supposed to think too much about it, I think.
I mean, yeah, it's a thing in this universe, but yeah, it's a gag right. more than anything else.
It's a gag more than anything.
I thought her entire family got killed by the monsters, but it was just her, like, other animal friends or animal. Like, I think they had a dog, a cat, the Elizabeth. And then the entire human family. And I thought everyone except her got killed. But I guess it was just a dog and cat that got killed. And I misunderstood.
I don't remember.
I don't remember either.
I guess I was surprised to see her father alive or her owner or whatever. So I was like, oh, I guess I misunderstood what happened in the previous episode when she was giving her backstory.
Well, in Chickenese, he does explain that he had brought the thing that she had requested. So he's brought this thing, something in a case. We don't see it yet, but he's brought her something special. Even like there's like a little moment where the butler is kind of like, oh my gosh, he speaks perfect Chickenese. Anyway, we cut back and Hikari has been ordered not to kill Keiji specifically because they arrive at the warehouse base or whatever of these devils. And they're kind of talking about it. And they're like, the rooster with the crown, you are not allowed to kill him. But the others, that's fine. Just
yeah,
not
they recognize Keiji. Him. Yeah, when the chickens show up and confront the devils recognize Keiji. It's like, oh, I've been given orders. I'm not sure if they spotted Piyoko because, and this will obviously be relevant later in the episode, but I remember the mom was kind of like, oh, Piyoko needs to live or saying to herself, but it seems like that her children or her underlings, whatever you call it, never got orders to not fuck with Piyoko. So I'm not sure if they noticed her there, but that was a little,
I think they do notice her in a little bit. I think they kind of do notice her being around. Anyway,
yeah, but you think there'd be a no-kill order for her as well, given
maybe
the mother was talking about in the previous episode that she needs to be protected. But yeah, I'm a little, I guess, yeah.
Well, they decide to have a battle. The devils send some of these lesser, I want to say lesser, but they're just like demons, demons at them. A bunch of goofy ones, you know, like a big eyeball one and a bunch of like nondescript ones, basically.
I mean, I think lesser is fine. These are obviously the weaker slash dumber ones as opposed to the higher tier class that Morio or the Octopus dude belong to.
Keiji does a new move that he called, because he's using it. He uses his special move, it's like Kokikoko or whatever, which is a Japanese onomatopoeia for chicken crow. But then he uses a special version of that in this battle called Totem Ko, where he ends up like knocking them into like a beam or something. That's kind of fun.
I think he uses vibration of his voice to explode a nearby beam. The beam shatters into metal fragments and those fragments hit all the nearby demons.
Yeah. And meanwhile, his brother is attacking and he uses a special move called Rapid Wind Strike. And of course, it's more of that sort of like chicken kung fu, basically. And as the battle continues on, Elizabeth shows up and she has her new weapon that was brought to her, and it is called the DEG, or the Digital Energy Gun. And this is a special weapon designed specifically for her, and specifically has a purpose is to knock out demons. It doesn't kill them or destroy them. It just knocks them out. It like makes them fall asleep, essentially, or knocks them out.
I think she said they paralyzes them for like several days or something.
Yeah,
because I think it's like electric weapon, so or something.
Right, and the whole point being is that, you know, she doesn't want to kill demons because there's a lot of them that apparently are good.
I mean, these ones are probably, most of them are probably quote unquote good, or it's unclear, and they don't want to take
clear,
a chance before confirming.
You know, it could very well be. I was thinking about this. It could very well be they're all good, and that the only ones we've seen are bad are ones that have been possessed. So we don't know that. That'll be interesting if that turns out to be true. But before we get to the commercial break, it's Morio. Morio is summoned to fight as well. And this, of course, makes Keiji's crown curl. It's just his like catchphrase. By the way, this was a super, well, this and Dandadan on both. Like the commercial breaks were much later in the episode, Dandadan especially. But we'll get to that. When we come back from the commercial, Elizabeth uses another move from her gun that she calls the Raijin Energy Shot. Now, Raijin is, I think, also the code name for this weapon. So I wrote that down. Again, this is mostly a battle episode. Octopas shows up. He's like, you know, he was rescued. So now he shows up and he's going to hold Morio in place so that Piyoko can go inside Morio's head and like kill the parasite that's controlling him. That's the plan. There's a lot of like Keiji and Piyoko being like, are you sure about this? You could die, you know? And she's like, this is what I can do.
Yeah, it's definitely, I wouldn't say like father-daughter vibes. Like that's not necessarily their relationship, but it kind of gave me that energy, if that makes any sense. Like obviously combatants trying to figure out how to beat these games about killing them, but there was definitely like a mutual respect, camaraderie, and like Keiji kind of legitimately concerned for Piyoko's well-being, because I think he understands this mission is kind of suicidal, as you know, yeah. You know, foreshadowing.
While this is going on, Keisuke continues to fight off other demons to protect them, and he ends up using another move. This one I actually liked the name of quite a bit, which is called Explosive Chicken Leg, which is just, I mean, just the way it sounds is funny because it's like chicken leg.
Yeah, good job by the voice actors saying these silly names as seriously as possible.
Yeah, it must be fun to record these episodes. Piyoko crawls up Morio's nose and kind of like explores through his body. It's very gross. This whole sequence is very disgusting. But they end up finding the brain, and then she finds the big parasite in there. She tries fighting it. She's got like a nail or something.
Yes, just a nail.
Oh,
I mean, it's the only thing she can really carry, right? Just a weapon of some sorts.
Right. She tries attacking it a couple times and it just kind of knocks her away and ends up scratching her really bad. And she's like, kind of starts to doubt herself. She's like, I can't do this. And then she's like, wait a minute. I noticed something. It can't move. If I can get behind it, you know, I can attack it from behind. She tries to do that, but even that fails and ends up hitting her so hard. It looks like she's died. Like she's bleeding out.
Well, no, what happened? Well, I will say quickly that I was going to laugh because I thought she was actually going to succeed, that the parasite couldn't actually defend itself from behind, but then it just grows a tendril and it impales her. So it's not just like it looks like she got hit. She's impaled, like her, you know, she's bleeding out. She's like skewered, and then that she falls to the ground, bleeding out, and we presume. And then that's the very end where a symbol appears on her chest and then her Mangekyo Sharingan activates.
Yes, she opens her eyes and it's like, dun, dun, dun. Now, this might have been a coincidence, but when it stabbed her, it did kind of look like the same thing that the devils do, but it could just be him stabbing him.
Oh, you mean the puncture thing, the when you do the head?
Because it was like a very pointy looking jab, and I thought, is she getting one?
Well, I think it's just, yeah, I think it's just her, in like, thorax is just like gone, because it's just, she's a little chick, so.
It's yeah, they like, don't normally bleed out, I don't think, when this happens. I guess we don't know, we've never really seen it, but like, yeah, I don't think it looked like she was bleeding out to die. And then she does die, like her heart stops, you hear it in the soundtrack, right, yeah. But then that's when she like awakens, and it's more likely, I think, that we're going to see this is her like power up, right? So this is when she's going to get power, probably.
Yeah, I mean, they've been foreshadowing this pretty well, so we can't say it's out of left field, but it's still jarring when you just look at her eye and it's like literally the Mangekyo Sharingan. Like, I'm not joking, it's just like literally that. But yeah, we can't say it wasn't foreshadowed, but it's still kind of like, oh Jesus, oh wow, damn.
All right, and that is this episode of Rooster Fighter. A lot of fun. Any other thoughts you guys want to say anything about this?
The only thing I want to mention is Elizabeth called her dad and basically was like, hey, I need this, like, I guess she said, this didn't happen on screen, but like, I need this, like, I need a weapon to like stun enemies. Can you do that for me? And he, or actually, I guess that's not even, he just, because he later in the episode says, like, what do you even need this for? So she basically must have told him, like, I need a stun weapon. can you do that for me? And he's like, yes, daughter, or chicken pet, or whatever I refer to you as. And I'll do this in 4 hours. And he's like, I think you mentioned this in the thread. It's like Batman, just, you know,
yeah.
Got a whole laboratory of scientists, I guess, working under this family, put together this gun in like a few hours. And apparently didn't even know the reason why. Just like, yeah, you could have the stun gun. Anything for my daughter.
This very much feels like she's like the Batman character of the show.
She's always been like, she doesn't have the superpowers, but she has the electric sword and whatnot, and she's always handy with tech. So like, yeah, you could say that, I don't know, Keiji's Superman, Kisuke's, I wouldn't say Wonder Woman because he's, you know, a dude. But you know, the DC trios, Batman, Superman and Wonder Woman. And so, I don't know, it doesn't match up exactly here, but you get the point I'm making.
All right. So that's Rooster Fighter. Again, it's a goofy show, but it's enjoyable. At least that's the way I see it. All right. Let's move on to my favorite show on the block, Donda Don. Donda Don Season 2, Episode 7. Feeling kind of gloomy. All right. It's been a couple of days, so I'm going to have to refresh my memory a bit. A lot happens in this episode. And like I said, this episode, like, it wasn't until 10 till, I think, the hour before we got a commercial break, which was, like, pretty late. So a lot happens in the first half. We're back at the where we left off. We're at the Maid Cafe, and Okarun is freaking out. The gal pals are having a blast, giving Momo a hard time. They do the typical things that you do at a maid cafe. You know, they order the goofy, you know, dishes, and then they get the camera, and everybody poses for the camera, and they do a Momo tri-beam pose for the camera.
And eat your heart out.
And then they end up leaving. And right before the girls leave, but then Okarun kind of waits there for a second because, like, I think Momo's standing outside with the sign, right? You know, trying to lure customers in. And she's like, what are you doing? And he's like, well, you know, I need to stay here, you know, in case, you know, it's a bad part of town. You don't want to walk alone, home alone. And she's like, oh, I could take care of myself or whatever. And he's like, oh, okay. And then he leaves. And it's kind of, she kind of gives him like a look, and it's just like, just more awkward, like, love stuff where it's like he's trying to be chivalrous, but he's also kind of, you know, he doesn't have the courage. And then she's also trying to not be overly forward, but then she's like kind of being distant, and it's like just awkward, but it's just, you know,
awkward teenage, you know, romance stuff.
Yeah. And he asks her like, well, when are you done? And she's like, 10 o'clock. And then this scene is actually kind of cool the way that they did it.
Yeah.
You know, it's a montage, but it's, you know, there are two parts about the montage that I think work out really well. Like having the camera angle, so to speak, be the clock that Momo keeps looking at because she's just, you know, we've all been in that situation where you just want time to pass faster. So you just keep looking at the clock in terms of like, how many hours do I have left? You know, how long is my shift? Blah, blah, blah. And then also, of course, the music selection during this scene being this sort of like classic. Someone mentioned it's a Chopin piece. So
yeah, Chopin. Yeah. Which there's a lot of classical music in this episode. And there's been classical music in this show before. But like, yeah, this is going to be a huge payoff at the end of this episode. But yeah, they're kind of dropping it here early with this Chopin piece as she's doing her montage.
But in terms of the whole mood of this scene, I think sets it perfectly that she's just kind of going through the motions of this job that she has now. And it's literally like a repetitive montage where she's doing the same things over and over, and her face, like, demeanor changes throughout the montage. Like, she's getting more and more like kind of, I don't know what the word is, but she's like
worn down.
She's not really enjoying it. She's just kind of like going through the motions. And like, she just wants to do anything, be anywhere but there. And she just keeps looking at the clock. So it was kind of, I think the tone that it sets is more or less perfect.
It's great stuff. Again, this is more of that like stuff I was talking about last week, where it's this artistic, what they're doing here. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not saying that all shows are bad if they don't reach this level, but it's just something I notice about this show where it's like, they're clearly just, they're talented. Like, they're talented, the people who make this show, because they do these artistic things. It works really well. Anyway, it does finally reach 10 o'clock and she changes, her coworkers are like, oh, you did a great job. See you later. And she's walking out and she kind of just stands there for a second, looks in both directions and waits because she thinks Okaroon's going to be there. And she doesn't see him. So she's like kind of let down and she starts to walk. And then he comes running up and he's like, I'm here. And so he was just sort of waiting nearby, I guess, or maybe he came
maybe
back.
Maybe a little late or something.
We don't explicitly know that, like, he was probably in some sense like conflicted. Like, I don't want to be, you probably don't want to be clingy, but you also don't want to like leave her to be. So he's probably deciding over that 4-hour period, like, do I go take Momo home or not? And then in the end, he obviously decided that he would.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I think he was just late. I think he just wanted to be there early and he was just late. But he may have been late because, as you said, he may have been overthinking things, or, you know, right, could have been doing something else. But yeah, he definitely meant to be there. He was just late.
And so they walk and Momo kind of holds his hand and, you know, it's more of that sort of like touchy feely, you know, very, very subtle stuff.
I think what I like about this part is that I think it's Okaroon tries to go in initially for, tries to be kind of more upfront about it. I think I'm trying to remember if he goes in for a hug or a handshake or something, but then I think he eventually like leaves his hand out in a way for Momo to easily grab it and hold it. So he kind of like, well, Momo, if you want to, I'm just going to leave this right here. And then she wants to. So he doesn't say that. He's like, his body language is kind of like welcoming, kind of subtle, like,
leaves this is the stuff I love.
And then she grabs it. And like, yeah.
It's the stuff I love. Like, it's you don't need the dialogue, right? Like, it's so written. Right. Their characterizations are so well done in their facial expressions and in their emotions. And it's like, you just get it, right? I love it. I think a lesser show would have to like have like they would have like inner monologues being like, oh my gosh, you know, or whatever.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, we cut back to Seiko's house and we can see that Manjiro, the monk guy, is trying to move Gigi. Gigi sort of concentrating and sitting in place, and he's like, I cannot move him. He's like as solid as a rock. This is like a demonstration of his psychic abilities.
Yeah, I think she calls him a prodigy once more. Yeah,
it was still like the meditation technique that Seiko was teaching to try to like center his chi, which helps him control his evil eye and whatnot. So,
and yep. And then she's like, well, let's try the soy sauce test. And then he's like, no, we can't do that. It's too risky. And she's like, all right, let's just try it. Come on, let's just try it. And then basically it's just her dropping a little tiny drop of soy sauce on his arm. And we kind of watch as he like psychically tries to hold the evil eye in. You can start to see him transform slightly, but he's able to push it back. And it was like super draining to him, but Seiko's like really impressed. She's like, oh, that was actually, you did a really good job, actually. That was surprising.
Yeah, she mentioned specifically like, okay, room temperature liquids you can manage, at least to some degree, but it's the cold stuff that he can't.
Right.
Well, I don't think she says any. She doesn't say that, but she implies like, okay, room temperature, you're good at that.
Yeah, well, you're okay with room that, now, but it's
that anything,
be, yeah,
anything colder
else
than room temperature is going to be a problem,
right?
For now,
as we'll see. And so when we then see that Momo and Okaroon have returned, and I think Seiko's like, "Where have you been?" And she's like, "Oh, I got a job.
See you later." And this is one of those things that, like, for now, like they were mentioning earlier, it just seemed like, you know, it wasn't that important. It's like, oh, they mentioned that it's cold outside and that they're kind of cold. And that's one reason they're holding hands. And like, she's like, it's not so cold now, is it? Blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, that's just like a setting thing. And then they get back into the house and they're like, she even kind of like sings songs to herself, like, I could use some hot water. She becomes important.
It's very important. I didn't pick up on any of this. And you're right. Even in the previous episode, too, there was a lot of them like sleeping in sleeping bags and stuff. And I wasn't thinking too much about it being cold. But you're right. It really is cold, which is important for what's happening next. But anyway, Ira sees Okarun, and it's like
she's got her crush on Okarun herself, and she just wants to go greet him.
Well, casually drinking a boba tea, you know, which becomes relevant in about 2 seconds.
So she comes rushing at him, but then at the same time, Gigi's kind of walking forward, and she bumps into him, splashes him, and in an instant,
and everything kind of goes like slow down Matrix style here. Like everyone is like almost like prepared for this. Like Seiko pulls out like a charm. Everyone else, or at least like Momo and Okarun, I think, start to splash. Like they know they're gonna have to splash the hot water like immediately. But the evil eye is like prepared for this and kind of creates like a barrier. And none of those like strikes work in that moment. Like he was like prepared for the splash of water and prevented it. Or they were just a bit too slow.
I think Momo and Okarun were actually drinking hot water to warm themselves up. And I think they already had it on hand. And then they saw what happened with the evil eye about to activate, so to speak. And then so they kind of got in the prepared mode. But I think that's what helped them get so up to speed, because they already had the hot water in their hands for like other purposes.
Yeah, but then they were still not fast enough.
Right, and because the evil eye has
learned how to avoid this, or at least
he uses this ability we saw a couple episodes ago, where he creates like a barrier. I didn't think it may have looked like this before, but it definitely looks like it here, where it looks kind of like it's in the shape of a house, and it may probably look like that before too.
It was like that before in when he was fighting Okarun a few episodes ago. Okay. It looked like that before too.
Yeah, so he has like this ability to create this sort of house around him that's a barrier, and he captures her inside. Unfortunately, she had her hands up. So the water is actually outside the roof of the house. She can't like drop it on him or anything. And so he's got her. And while he's kind of coming towards her and he grabs her by the neck and starts to choke her, you can see Okarun outside. And he is just beating on the wall of this house trying to get in. And he's like starting to transform and just is like so angry he can't get in to help her.
And Okarun is the key thing here, but it also shows Seiko. Like I think it even shows later she like hurt her hand, like her she had like some sort of charm or seal or something that she was trying to break it with, but it didn't work. But yeah, basically Momo is like seems like she's she's caught. She has no help.
Yeah, she's done for. But she has one last ace up her sleeve. She spits, and turns out that the hot water she had just drank right before he transformed, she'd never swallowed it. So he spits it right on his face, and then that cures him. And so everything's over. And she was very clever in that moment. And, you know, everybody kind of rushes in to look at Momo and everything. And Gigi's kind of standing there, and he's just like in his underwear, like he always is, you know, whenever he transforms or whatever. And he's just standing there, and he's like, he just has this look on his face, and he's just like, he feels awful.
Yeah, he sees Okarun, like, you know, trying to comfort Momo after all of this, of course. And then he even takes a look at, like, Seiko's arm, which is, like, all busted up. And he's kind of, like, realizing this is my fault in a way. You know, it's not really his fault, but he feels
No, guilty. It's not his fault. But and she says that. She says that. Right. Seiko's like, it's not your fault, kid. But, like, he definitely is feeling it, you know.
It's kind of his fault in the sense that he could have exercised the evil eye last episode, and he fought against that. So obviously he didn't mean to harm anyone, but they were still in this scenario because he wanted to be in the scenario. And of course his friends were like, we'll help you. We'll fight the evil eye. We'll put up with this. But even Mondro is kind of, as he talks a little later, this is untenable. Like we can't keep doing this. It's like stupid. And you know, he's right. So, but
also this is just a small thing, and it doesn't really matter that much, and it might just be a recreation of what happened in the manga, but I kind of liked when Mamonji or whatever his name is was talking to Seiko. A part of that conversation was like through like the frosted glass window on the door. I kind of like that.
Yeah.
That framing of the conversation.
Well, after those events, everyone goes to sleep. But before they fall asleep, Ira's laying next to Momo, and she just sort of apologizes. She says, I'm sorry. I should have been more careful, you know, and it's like, Momo's like, yeah, well, you know, whatever. She feels pretty guilty as well. Then we come to the next day, and we see Peeny Weenie is out. He's got a whole cattle farm, and he's out milking his cows and feeding his cows and doing all that stuff.
I don't think he owns the farm. I think he works for someone else there. I think he mentioned something to that effect the previous episode, or he got someone to work, hire him or something.
Oh, I don't remember that. I just thought he had his own farm. Okay. Well, whatever. He's at a farm.
Totally inconspicuous, normal human being.
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of interesting. He has like a special human disguise on. The only thing that like gives it away, aside from his kind of giant face, is that he's got his little like eyeball antenna sticking out of his hat. But other than that, yeah, he kind of passing as a human here. And this really excites Okaroon because he's like, oh, this proves that aliens are living among us. He asks him, how many aliens are there on Earth? And he's like, I don't know.
Which is a fair answer.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not their keeper. They can do what they want.
Yeah. And yeah, he's just living his, you know, farming life now. And but Okaroon's like, hey, I need your help. I want you to teach me how to punch. I need to learn how to be strong at punching, so that I can protect people. And Peeny Weenie's like, I don't have time for that.
Yeah, so instead they kind of did like, there's like a mini montage where he just like, they just chore a bunch of like it's like wood or something that they're just carrying. So like menial labor.
I think it's hay or something, but something okay, heavy or something.
I just forgot what it was. But yeah, it's just kind of like, hey, move these things from over there to over there.
I'm off base here, but I always interpreted it as Peeny Weenie actually training. He was like, he heard Okun's request and like trained. It was like, okay, I'm not gonna like, you know, do straight up show you how to like punch and whatnot, but I'll subtly train you in another way as kind of like we're friends and whatnot. So I think he's being actually pretty deliberate here in like training Okun, though I'm not sure if Okun necessarily realizes it. But that's how I always interpreted this.
That's what I thought too. It's just like Okaroon doesn't even realize that like the physical labor is the training.
Yeah, this is very Karate Kid.
Mm-hmm.
This is the same technique that Mr. Miyagi would use. After that arduous day, we cut back. It's the evening now, and Manjaro is out talking outside with Seiko, who's having a cigarette, and he's like you said, Crocodile. He's just like, this is dumb. We can't keep doing this. It's just too risky, you know. Kind of convinces Seiko too. She's like, yeah, it's too bad. I guess we're going to have to give up on this.
I think Seiko had a good speech or mini speech about how it's the job of adults to kind of like protect children and like let them do what they want to do. Cause they're only going to be children for so long and whatnot. And I think Mondra had a good counter where it's also jobs for adults to make sure children don't get themselves killed or like hurt and whatnot. So it's kind of like the push and pull about how you want to be a parent or a role model for children around you, kind of like let them be free to express themselves, but also make sure they don't hurt themselves because they can certainly do that. And so it's kind of interesting pull and pull between these two individuals. Kind of a very mature conversation, even though there's a pretty big gap in age between them as well. But
yeah, that was a great scene. But I guess the real takeaway, though, is that Seiko is agreeing that probably not worth trying to keep this up. Okaroon is in the backyard and he's feeling kind of gloomy, too, like everyone's feeling kind of gloomy.
Yeah, he just got back from the, you know, from the farm and he just like, I still want to learn how to punch. And he was doing his training or whatever. I guess he found Momo's like, someone said it in the thread, like boxing manga, something No Joe.
Oh yeah,
No Joe. Yeah, it's a pretty famous series. In case like, it's
I've heard of it. I'm not familiar with it, but I've heard of it.
Okay.
Yeah, it wasn't even like a knockoff. It's straight up like that character.
So yeah, right now he's sort of obsessed with like learning how to punch, and then Terrible Granny's like, "What the heck are you doing?" So,
like, yeah, in her Tober Granny way, she's like really a jerk, and she just walks up. It's like, what crawled up your ass? I mean, this isn't what she says, but that's of the effect of like, what are you loser doing here, you dumb loser? What's your problem?
I think that's what she said verbatim.
And you know, he explains to her, and she kind of like, and, you know, again, she's, the thing is that Turbo Granny is helpful if she, but she kind of does it in like a mean way, but she is helpful. And in this moment, she's like, well, here's the thing. Do you want to learn how to throw a punch or do you want to learn how to be strong? And I think he says, like, I want to learn a prone punch. He's like, no, you idiot. You want to learn how to be strong.
Yeah. Okaroon's like, I guess his thought process here is a little bit silly. He's like, if I throw a punch, then I can be strong. It's like, I think you need to be strong to throw a punch. Like, I think you got it backwards.
Yeah, TurboGrafx is making a broader point about the meaning of strength and the ability to protect your loved ones and so on and so forth. Okun's kind of narrow casting on just like, I gotta beat up Evil Eye. I gotta punch him real good in the face. So, yeah.
I like the line too, where she says that, like, have you forgotten whose powers you have? I can teach you. It's basically what she's saying. And she offers to do that. When that's when we finally get the commercial break. When we come back, we see that TurboGrafx and Okun have gone to the school at night. But then also Ira is there. She followed them. And she's also kind of like, you know, trying to get close to Okun. But then every time like TurboGrafx says anything, she like changes. There's like a funny sequence where she's like, she turns into the acrobatic Silky for a moment and says, I can stamp you out of existence or whatever I need to. Starts saying some really mean things like, you stupid bitch. And then she transforms back. And she's like, oh, I'm sorry, Okun. That was the TurboGrafx speaking. I would never say things like that. The Silky was saying that. That was, I would never do that. And then TurboGrafx says something else. And then like Ira, just as her normal self, just goes, shut up.
She was about to drop some slurs there. Like she was pissed.
They make their way into the music room, and TurboGrafx gets up onto a piano and she starts like tapping the keys on the piano, and she says, she just kind of goes like ding 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 ding. This is your rhythm. It's a slow, simple rhythm. And she starts to just basically explain combat rhythm, this concept of combat rhythm, how many moves you can do quickly. And how Evil Eye is way faster, but it's not that it's so much faster. It's just that it's using combat rhythm differently. It's doing more moves in the same number of beats, basically. And then the piano starts to play on its own, and TurboGrafx kind of chuckles. He says, "Well, that's not me."
So this is one. This is something I'm not entirely certain of yet. It was like, was TurboGrafx like expecting or planning for these? Musical spirits to like be there, or was this just kind of a happy accident?
They explain it next episode, like, and I can tell you yes or no, but
don't say, but I would say that I'm thinking yes.
Yeah, I would. That's what I'm guessing, because if she just wanted to point out like a rhythm thing, you could take, you know, a chopstick and hit a table or whatever to get your point across. Why else would she want to take you specifically to this music room? Like, so
I will say, though, I kind of just realizing this now, that their school is like super haunted, right?
Yeah.
They've got like all these like composer ghosts, and then they've got like the whatever his name was, the anatomical dummy guy, and like
Taro,
his girlfriend. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like this freaking high school is cursed, or middle school, excuse me. I don't know. Whatever.
They're high schoolers.
They're high schools. Okay. Anyway, so yeah, suddenly what looks like a giant-headed Beethoven is there.
Yeah, someone in the thread listed out like all the different composers that are there, like Bach, Beethoven.
Oh, I think Chopin is amongst them, right?
I don't remember.
Probably. I would assume.
Parajan.
The cool thing about it is that it looks like them, because you can't copyright people. I mean, these people are like...
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, they've been dead for hundreds of years, most of them.
Yeah, so. Yeah, exactly.
All of them? I've been, yeah, for a long time.
So, yeah, that's where we end off. I guess this is going to be a tutorial. And also, it should be clear, too. It's not just for Okun, because Ira is there as well. So,
yeah, they showed a little preview with basically it's Okun and Ira. You know, they both have, I guess, inherited powers, right? And versus these things. And who knows how this will turn out. The show is very creative, so it's hard to predict what they'll do.
Yeah, that was my comment after the episode. I'm just like, this show is so different than anything else, but it's also super creative and I like it. But I was just like, I can't predict where things are going to happen. Like, I don't know where things are going to go in this show. It's random. I wasn't expecting the ghosts of composers to show up and fight them. I mean, it's so weird. Okay, yeah. So that's episode 7, feeling kind of gloomy.
A lot happened in that episode.
Yeah.
Like, remember when we were talking about Momo as a maid? Like, that was the same episode.
It does.
A lot happened.
Yeah. It was like 2 episodes ago. Great stuff, though. Any other thoughts on this?
No, Dandadan being Dandadan in the best way possible.
Nothing to complain about that I can think of.
I just have a small criticism.
Oh, like, cool.
did Gigi really need to like tear off Momo's shirt? That just kind of felt
there was that. I did notice that too.
It's like, yeah, that, you could get the point across without that. Like, it just kind of felt like having your cake and eating it too. Like,
yes, it was very subtle though. It was also
like
they didn't
do anything. They didn't do anything like explicitly like creepy with that. It's just kind of like, you did. I don't know. Yeah.
Maybe it was like equal opportunity because like we're watching him walk around all the time in his underwear.
I mean, I don't really think that was fan servicey. I think it was just.
I agree. You know, but I also think, but Seda's right. They didn't have to do that. So it's like, why?
I'm not a cynical person, I don't think, but just like, yeah, let's take any opportunity to rip off Momo's shirt. Like, okay. And again, it's a minor criticism.
It feels like the kind of thing where like, if it was a male character, like, they would still probably, if that was Okrun, like, I think his shirt would probably been ripped off in that scenario too, or something. Like, possibly. Like in contrast to like the first episode where I think, you know, we've had this conversation already, and, you know, so I'm not going to retread that ground, but I do definitely think there was more of a gendered aspect there.
For sure. That felt more deliberate. Here. This felt more like a casualty of the situation.
Again, just a minor criticism. I don't really care that much. Just like, I noticed it.
I think it's worth noting it. I also think it was good that the show didn't dwell on it because it felt like
it could get lost in the moment. Like, it wasn't like they didn't focus it or highlight it. It just happened.
Okrun didn't even mention it. You know, he would have been the one, right? But he doesn't.
Right.
Right. It was more akin to like if you're a woman in a shonen anime and you're getting hit by a laser blast, you know, you probably or whatever, or you know, like. Battle damage kind of just as a function of if there was a fight as opposed to like anything trying to be sexual.
I think I took it mostly that way because there wasn't a reaction from anyone. The scene was too serious to make it feel like that's supposed to be anything other than just like her clothes got a little ripped.
Yeah.
But I am also with you, Seda, in that like they had to make a choice to do that. So it's like, okay. All right. Can't be perfect, but it's a good show. Well, let's move from one good show to, well, something else.
Show.
Let's talk about Blue Lock. Blue Lock, episode 14. The Geniuses and the Average Joes.
So with that title, I wonder, like, what is this title in, like, Japanese? Do Japanese people have, like, a phrase that is, like, equivalent to Average Joe?
I assume they do. It's pretty common saying in, like, every culture and language.
But I just wonder what is their saying? Like, the average, whatever they, what's the average Japanese name? I don't know.
I wonder.
Or do they literally say Average Joe? I don't know. Actually, I'm curious. I don't know. It's a minor curiosity.
Find the Japanese title and then run it through Google Translate and see what we get. Well, while you're doing that, so we cut into the episode when we see that Isagi is feeling worthless. He's not able to contribute anything to this. He realizes that Nagi is carrying him right now. And then my next note here is that he and Nagi have a conversation that basically equates to Nagi saying, get good. He doesn't say that, but it's basically that.
Okay, so the Japanese title of this episode, so the Average Joe part is like an English kind of like elaboration or whatever. The Japanese title of this episode is Tensai to Bonsai, which I guess generally means, Tensai means like expert, and Bonsai is just like, you're just a tree or a plant. So it's kind of like expert to normal, which I guess is the same idea, genius to an average.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So
that sounds like their version of the expression. So
they're kind of hanging out in that like waiting area where they pick the next team they're going to fight, and in comes walking Baru the king. We see that he is lost.
Yeah, for a moment I was like, wait, shouldn't Baru be with somebody? Because if he lost, he should have lost with another person. What happened to them? And in comes the most memorable character of the entire show. Everyone remembers this guy. We were just waiting for him to come back.
So he was on Isagi's team then, right?
Yes, he was.
Apparently.
So everyone in the thread was wondering, like, who is this guy? And I was actually wondering, like, okay, I know there were a couple people on that original team that weren't very memorable. Was this the guy who, like very momentarily, like, said he approached soccer, like, courting a girlfriend? And no, it's not that guy. That was a different forgettable guy. This is the other forgettable guy who really had no redeeming or memorable qualities whatsoever.
Yeah, at least you remember the weird date wants to date soccer guy. Like, you couldn't even remember this guy. Like, who's this guy?
Yeah, he's the least memorable character.
He was kind of just a background guy, and he had, like, you know, some chirps here and there, but yeah.
I mean, they had flashbacks later in this episode if he was there. Like, I mean, you could say, oh, they inserted him into those flashbacks. He was never actually there, and they're, like, kind of pretending or something. I'm pretty sure those were, like, legit flashbacks from earlier episodes.
He was there. He was just always just, like, had, like, the occasional, like, line, like, exposition or something, right? He just never did anything.
But what the problem with this show, this is the problem with Blue Lock, is that when that guy walks in, Isaki calls him out by name, and he's like, oh, it's you. Yeah. And as a viewer, I'm like, who the hell are you? What? And it's like, I think Blue Lock, the show, is trying to make it seem like I should know that character when I clearly do not remember this character.
I just get the Snoop Dogg meme of who? It's all like.
So Baru is, he comes in after Baru. And Baru is also giving them a lip about, like, oh, he's still, like, got his, like, conceited, like, oh, you're a bunch of donkeys, you're a bunch of nobodies, blah, blah, blah.
Still the king.
He's the king.
Better or worse.
Anyway, he goes they go to their room, and they kind of comment on the fact that this is like a prison now. It's like a cell that they're in.
But yeah, the next match is until 24 hours. They can't, there's like a rule saying they can't challenge another team for another 24 hours. So they go to, I guess, a new set of quarters which are downgraded from their previous set.
I was thinking about this during it, and I was just thinking, like, had they had any contact with the outside world? Because it really is a prison, right?
I assume they've probably got a chance to call their parents or something.
No. if the show isn't illustrating to me, I'm going to take the worst case scenario that these people are prisoners. Just because, like, if the show doesn't want it to make it clear that they are doing this, like, I mean, I think they could leave if they wanted to, but I'm just like, it's funny to me that the characters in this moment comment about how this feels like they're in a prison now. And it's like, in what ways is it not a prison?
But I think from the parents' perspective, because these are all just like students, right? The parents must think they're like, oh, our sons are, you know, at like this soccer training camp. Or whatever,
I guess,
and they're in fine hands. Like, they don't think their sons have been abducted.
That's
or something,
point.
Right?
Okay, I could see that.
Like, they're not causing, you know, like a riot, like, you know, or
I mean, I think the police would get involved if people legitimately thought their children were being kidnapped.
I'm spinning all these scenarios in my head where, like, Ego has, like, people at high levels of government, like, controlling the cops, preventing them from getting into Blue Lock. I don't know.
I mean,
that's
Blue Lock
not
is
happening.
A public,
I'm just thinking.
Blue Lock is a public, like, institution. Like, they had that press conference back. So, like,
I know. I'm just being silly. I'm not really being honest about this. I'm just goofing.
I also don't think the show put that much thought into it either, though.
I know.
They're at Blue Lock. Don't think about it.
I think the point of this is to point out the fact that they had nicer gigs before, and now they're, like, being treated more.
There's also a part in this episode where I forget if I think Nagi or somebody comments on, like, the food, because they're back down to, like, the natto and pickled radishes. And then Isaki even mentions, like, well, I'm actually used to this, you know, now. But, like, we already talked about the food stuff before, but they're down to, like, the lowest denominator, like, food, because they're in the loser's bracket right now or whatever.
Yeah. There was also a bit too that apparently Nagi sleeps like a vampire.
Yeah.
Whatever.
By the way, there was a new opening.
Yeah, there was a new opening. We'll talk about that at the end.
Sure.
But let's continue. So while they're eating, they do say that if we're going to succeed, we need to have a strong team. We're going to need a strong team, basically, is what they're saying. Because they both kind of realize that they need, I don't know, it's complicated, but they just say that. Okay. Anyway, I think Isagi goes to like mess around with Blue Lock Man and like do some practicing, and that's when Naruhaya shows up. This is the character that no one can remember. And he's kind of like talking to him, and he says, see, I know a lot about you, Isagi, because I'm just like you insofar that
we're the same.
Because I know I won't get picked, and that's the same as you because you will never get picked. Like, really kind of gives him like the evil eye in that moment. And then he says he wants Nagi. He says that my goal here is to get Nagi on my team.
Basically, I'm going to eliminate you. They're just saying to each other, basically, I'm going to eliminate you. And then they agree to...
I forget exactly what happens here, but they kind of like antagonize each other at this point where they basically like, all right, we're playing each other right now. Like they make that a... They kind of delayed the confrontation, but like, all right, we're going to play this 2-on-2 match. And we start that.
Yep. Yeah, that's when they agreed that they're going to challenge each other. Okay, we come back from the commercial break and the game starts. Right away out of the gate, Maru scores. He's super talented, obviously.
This feels also very Bleachy, like I mentioned in the last episode, where it's like, mm-hmm. his max range is 27 meters. And then like, wait, he just shot that from 29 meters.
Oh my gosh. Yep.
And he's also evolving.
And he even says like, you thought you knew how good I was?
Yeah, take a drink every time someone says evolve in the show and you'll die before this episode's over.
Well, while this is happening throughout the match, Nagi comes to an epiphany. He figures out his special formula and is able to score over Baru. And we get this long sequence where he's putting the pieces together, literally, figuratively. The puzzle pieces fall into place. I do not remember what it is. It's not important. It's just something about speed plus this equals that or something.
Like ball control and passing and one touching or something with the ball, or
he's just better now.
And they try to like have some sort of like Blue Lock logic to it or whatever. And it's like, whatever. I think really the Isagi at this point is just kind of like, well, I'm going to take care of Naruhaya. I can handle this guy, right? Maybe not.
Yeah. So suddenly out of nowhere, Baru and Naruhaya both make more scores, including Naruhaya, who makes a score. And then my next note is Naruhaya reveals why they chose to battle. And I don't remember why. I just wrote down he reveals it.
So. I think he just says that he knows what Isagi's like ability is, so he knows he can beat him.
Okay.
Something like that.
Oh, no, it says right here, because he's certain he could beat Isagi. That's why.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
I think they kind of argue like you need Isagi's useless if he doesn't have someone to pass him the ball. And right now he doesn't.
Right.
So, and then there's like a moment here, I think at the end of the episode, where Naruhaya gets behind them. And then there's like a flashback where Isagi's like, wait. And then like there was that one point where Naruhaya almost said in passing, like, my power is to get behind the enemy or whatever. Like, that's what he does. He gets behind people, however that works. But that's his ability.
This is another thing where they call back to like one of the first episodes where he's like, this is my special powers. I can get behind. And I'm like, nobody remembers this. But they like show a clip of him mentioning that. So
did the episode end 3-2, basically? Or?
They're still in the middle of the match.
Yeah. Right. I'm trying to remember how it ended, like what the score was when it ended. But okay.
They were behind, I think, the good guys. So I have two thoughts about this. First, I'll tell you my thought, and then or a thought I had, and then we'll talk about the opening. But the thought I was thinking about during this, and again, I'm being very pessimistic here about Blue Lock. I don't hate it, but I just like poking fun at it. And the way the show is doing all of this stuff, like about like, oh my God, everyone's evolving and so much, everyone's so powerful and they're like pulling off these unbelievable moves and they have incredible speed. And I'm just thinking to myself, wait a minute, aren't the Tokyo players all supposed to be like the worst? Like, how do they measure up to like the, it almost makes these people seem like they're the greatest soccer players ever.
I mean, it's all relative. I mean, they're,
I guess,
high school, they're doing well amongst each other, but obviously put them against any pro to get, you know,
but they're pulling off these amazing moves. Like, it's like, oh,
there's power scaling, probably.
I guess. Yeah.
Whoever wins Blue Lock is going to enter like like the next round at Red Lock or whatever against like the other countries.
Red Lock.
They're going to start over. Like, wow, we just beat Blue Lock.
I mean, yeah, if you watch a game of real soccer, like the things these kids are doing are impressive, but like there's definitely more impressive stuff out there.
Okay, fair enough.
It's overselling it is all I'm saying. I think Blue Lock is overselling these abilities to the point where it starts to make me feel like they're too talented.
It's because it's shown in manga, so we're also going to have to make it jazz it up a little bit. But, like, you know.
Is it just me, then? I mean, am I the only one who notices that? I just think it's kind of...
I mean, it's just obviously, like, exaggerated, you know, superpowers, whatever.
Right. It's just for sake of being a shonen battle manga, basically. But, like, you know, they're not odds, but it's just framed that way because
I guess you're right. Like if one of these superstar players came in who were really good, they would just wipe the floor of these guys, right? I guess that's
right. Yeah. Or any actual professional adult, you know, in a international league would just be run circles around these kids.
Yeah. Okay. So they did have a new opening. I like this opening better, but that's mostly because I didn't like the first one at all.
So this opening does some like interesting like kind of like color splash type of stuff. And I appreciate it for that because it's like the sort of animation that you could only do in an opening. Like this wouldn't work like in the show.
Yeah.
But it is a little bit like, it's almost a little bit too loud.
It feels like there's a lot of spliced footage from the show in there. There is a moment where there is. I don't have a strong opinion on this opening or the previous one. They're fine.
I think it's just a hair better.
Yeah, it's certainly much better, but I still don't think it's great. I think it's just like, it's all right. It's okay. It's not super memorable. All right, any other thoughts on Blue Lock?
Only thing I have to say is that I appreciate that Isagi got over his pity fest relatively quickly, because that's something that could have like took the whole episode, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that they squashed that decently quickly.
Yeah, I'm kind of glad that they kind of immediately had Nagi be kind of like, you know, the stern voice of reason. I think he even like grabs him by his hair and he's kind of like, hey, stop beating yourself up or whatever. Blah, 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 blah. Because we could have been mired in, you know, Izuki's misery for, you know, a whole episode or whatever. But Nagi kind of put a stop to it pretty quickly. So,
yeah.
Like, I don't mind it when a character has like, you know, a moment of uncertainty or lack of confidence or whatever. As long as they don't like linger on it, and they didn't, so it was fine.
All right, so that's Blue Lock. They continue to battle two on two. I think I'm assuming after this battle, would they go on to the 3v3? I guess.
Yeah, that's actually so they can't lose this match, right? Because if they lose, they're out, right?
Right.
You don't field yourself. Like, there's no losers bracket, so they have to win, or else the show would end. But if they win, like, they either get to pick one of these characters to join them, right? I guess they could lose, and then they could pick Isagi, and he would like the sword, but that would be weird, you know.
Oh yeah, I guess that is possible. Yeah, that could happen.
You know, they're not going to kick Isagi out of the show or whatever, but they could lose, and then like Nagi's out, but that'd be weird, I think. Anyways, like, if they win, like, they get to pick, you know, Mr. Asshole or Mr. Unforgettable. Like,
win-win situation. I can see it going either way there too, honestly. Because they could do the, like, we're reunited with nobody. Or it could be, oh, we got to deal with this asshole, you know.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's move on to the next show. Tokyo Revengers. Tokyo Revengers episode 14, Breakup. So a lot happens in this episode. Like, I don't want to say a lot happens in this episode. A lot of important things happen in this episode. So they go to a temple, and all of the Tokyo Manji gang is there, and they all kind of bow as Mikey arrives. He gets up onto the kind of a platform, and he speaks out to all his minions and says that They are there to name the new third division captain, and it is, it's going to be Takamichi, isn't it, guys? It's going to be Takamichi. No, it's Kisagi, like everyone assumed it would be Kisagi, of course.
And Takamichi, he does the thing where he's like, oh, of course it wasn't me. Why would it be me? Like, you say that, but you thought there was a chance.
Oh, that reminds me, too. And then he says, I'm not even in Tokyo Manji.
Yeah, he later in the episode, he was never like officially a member.
No.
Although that's sort of weird because like Draken gave him like Mikey's old outfit.
Yes. I was completely out. This felt like wrong to me. Like, I'm sure it's fine, but like, I was like, what? You're not in the gang? What?
Yeah. So like Takamichi was mistaken, but I also don't like blame him. Like if you're given like, hey, here's the leader's old Tokyo Manji outfit, it'd be like, oh, you would assume you're kind of part of the group.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it was really weird that he was never officially in it.
But like, I guess they
never did anything. They never had a ceremony or anything. So I guess. Anyway, Kisaki comes walking up, and of course, it's the guy we saw in, like, second episode or whatever with the glasses, and you know, he's got some thug with him as well.
And I think we've kind of known since like the second or third episode, like, all right, that guy's important.
Yeah. Well, dude, I'll tell you,
be a problem.
I saw from the second or third episode when I saw that guy, I'm like, he's the bad guy. Like, I knew right away. Like, it's just obvious.
She's got that shit-eating grin. Like, that's definitely a bad guy.
He uses that shit-eating grin a lot in this episode. Yep. Anyway, he gets up there, and all the Tokyo Mind's like, who is this guy? Why is he here? And then Mikey says that this is someone from Mobius, but we're going to need him if we're going to fight Valhalla. That's why we're going to have him in the group. Draken is skeptical. He's like, I don't know about this, Mikey. And then Takamichi gets so mad because he's like, this is Kisaki. This is the guy who had my girlfriend killed twice. He goes crazy and he runs up and he punches him.
Good plan.
And everybody gets mad.
I mean, like, emotionally, I get it, but also, like, what did you think would happen?
Right.
So, like there was no end game here. Like, there's no way this could have turned out good. So
everybody's kind of like, I mean, even Draken's like, what are you doing, Takamichi? And then Mikey's just kind of stunned. And all the other Tokyo guys are like, or Toman guys are just like, you idiot, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, before anything really has a moment to resolve, some other character walks up. This guy is named Baji. And he's like,
I think we briefly were introduced to this guy, like, in the big fight episode a bit back, where like all these other like captains showed up and he was just one of them.
Really?
Yeah. Like, I think it showed him briefly with like the crazy haired kid and the other captains. Okay. Yeah. He was there. I remember like the long black hair.
Okay. Well, him. Something's happened between then and now then.
Right.
Because we learned that, he's there to talk to Mikey and he's like, you know, blah, blah, blah. I'm out. And then who is that guy? And then, you know, as Mikey kind of explains, well, you know, it kind of explains a little bit later, but basically we kind of learn here that he was banned. Baji was banned from Tokyo Manji.
Well, he was like part of the, so this is kind of all stuff we're sort of learning like in context. And there's some exposition here where he's a captain, but he's like banned from the meetings. Like, he's not allowed to be at the meeting.
Okay.
So like, he's still like, at the moment, part of the gang, but he's not allowed to be at the meetings. So he shows up and Mikey's like, hey, you're not supposed to be here. And he's just kind of like, well, I'm going to punch Takamichi and then I'm out. And then he quits.
Yes, that's when he quits.
Mikey kind of just lets him go. He's just like, all right, you know, do what you want.
Yeah. And then Takamichi is punched. You're right. He punched in the face by this Baji guy. And then that's when we go to the commercial. When we come back, Mikey is waking up. Everyone's pretty much gone except for Takamichi. Or I'm sorry, except for Mikey. Mm-hmm. Kind of wakes up next to Mikey sitting there, and Mikey's like, hey, Takamichi. And that's when it's explained. We get the child. We learn that Baji was a childhood friend of Mikey.
And also, this part is a little bit silly, a little bit, where they talk about, like, here, the founding members, you know, were me, this guy, Pa, the silver haired guy whose name I forget, who was also there. And like, but Baji was one of the founding members of the gang.
Yeah. I don't find that hard to believe.
But then he kind of like says, like, he's always been this sort of kind of crazy where he's like, you just punch people because he's tired, or he sets a car on fire because he's bored or something like that. Like, okay.
I mean, that's a super deep cut here, but I remember that old Time magazine TV ad back from the 80s where they was like, they would always talk about like the Time Life history books about the Old West. And there was like, he punched a man because he snored too loud, or like shot a man because he snored too loud. And it's like, that's what it reminded me of. It's like, Baji just punches people because he snored too loud.
And, you know, Takemichi's response is, I think, the response we're supposed to have. Like, this Takemichi kind of like does like a goofy face and like, this guy's nuts. Like, yeah, I think that's the point we're supposed to get, is like, this Baji guy is a little bit kind of a little screwy.
Yeah, and then
silver-haired guy is there. I forget his name, starts with an M. He's one of the captains. He's been around.
He was listening.
Yeah, and long story short, basically, Mikey's like, hey, Takemichi's part of the gang now, like, officially, and he's in your group. Good luck.
Yes. And he also says, too, and he asks Takemichi, he's like, you really don't like that Kisaki guy, Takemichi kind of like lays it out, and he's like, look, I know you're not going to understand this. I know I'm just going to tell you that if you put this guy as a captain, it's going to destroy Tomon. It's the worst thing you can possibly do. And he's just expecting that like Mikey's going to be like, no, or whatever. Then Mikey just goes, okay, I'll get rid of him, but you got to do something for me first. And then he says, you need to go. Meet this guy, Kazutora.
He doesn't say that. No. He just like, okay, you have to go get Baji back.
Get Baji back. Like, I'm sorry, get Baji back. Okay, so I got ahead of myself. He's like, I want you to convince Baji to come back to our group, is what he said.
Kazutora was never mentioned like explicitly. Well, I mean, by Mikey is, or...
Not by Mikey, but he is explained because...
Basically, Takemichi, fine. He goes like, they're at a shrine, so he like washes the blood off himself. He has one of those like shrine like charms or whatever, and he finds like the photo in the charm that's like, oh, it's the founding members, all six of them. I thought there was only five, and yeah, there's a sixth guy there who he doesn't know the name of.
But he learns it from somebody. He learns it because I wrote it down.
We the viewers learn it.
Oh, okay. So my bad.
Here's what happened, if I remember correctly. So he sees the photo. And first of all, I have a comment on the photo. Like, he's like, oh, look how young they are. And I'm just thinking, like, how long ago is this? Like, 1 year? Because they're, like, all, like, 14 or 15. And it's like, you probably founded this, like, a year ago. Which I guess, you know, a middle schooler can change a lot in a year. But it's just kind of silly. Like, look how young they are from maybe a year ago. Or whatever. Anyways, he sees that sixth person, but Takemichi never learns the name. The stinger of the episode, it shows Baji in some alleyway walking up to that guy, and we know it's the same guy because he's got like a tattoo on his neck. And that basically, let me step back a bit. Takemichi even mentions like, oh, who's this guy? He's got a tattoo on his neck. And then we go like to we see this alley that Baji's in, and he's walking up to a guy who also has a tattoo on his neck. And he's like, so it's very obviously the same person 1 year later or whatever. And he's like, and Baji says like something like, hey there, Kazutora. Or is it Kazutora? Yeah. So like, Kazutora. That's where we, the viewer, learn the name, but Takemichi doesn't have the name.
So yeah, now the goal is he obviously, this Kazutora is going to be a piece in possibly getting Baji to come back or something like that. So
yeah, we kind of got introduced to, like two new characters here in this, I guess this is probably like the final conflict of the first season. You know, we're kind of diving into this. Obviously we have this Kisugi kind of main antagonist, you know, that's like the main problem that needs to be dealt with. But then like, what's up with this Baji guy? What's up with this Kazutora guy? And, you know, the immediate goal for Takemichi, our hero, is to get Baji back, but I have a feeling that's not going to be easy to do.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's like, I mean, the goal is to get Kisaki out of the,
yeah.
Because originally his plan was, I'm going to take over Toman, but obviously that's like an end of the show type thing, I think.
Yeah.
I think his initial goal now is to get Kisaki out. In order to do that, he has to first get this Baji guy back thing,
which, right. You know, and like then an episode ago, we didn't care about it at all. It's like, oh, I guess now we do.
Yeah. But again, that's kind of like, you know, like the second half of the show or whatever. And then, and then I think too that, oh God, I was going to go somewhere with this. What's up with the Baji stuff? Oh, I think this is all ultimately maybe going to lead to like a big Valhalla battle, right?
Probably.
So, because this is, I think that's where Baji's going, right? He's going to go to be with Valhalla. So, all right. So that is Tokyo Revengers for this week. A lot of shakeups in Toman. I mean, I do applaud Takemichi for just punching the guy, even if it was dumb. Like, I'd rather him do that than just sit there and just look, you know, and be like, yeah, I'm screwed. So he took action at least. There was one other thing I wanted to mention too. There was a moment, another one of these weird Mikey moments where he kind of like says something to Takemichi's like, if you do that again, I'm going to kill you. And it wasn't one of those moments where he's like, I'm just kidding. He didn't do that. He just was like, you do that again and I'll kill you. And I guess that's just supposed to be like the darker side of Mikey peeking out, like his like true like mob bossness coming out, I guess. Yeah, it's weird.
It's hard to know exactly like how much does he mean it, or is it just some sort of like perverse like encouragement in a way? Like,
I can't tell.
Like, you know, I'm gonna get you so tense that you do this, you know, the right way or something. I don't know.
I think the way I took it this time was that it, like I said, I think it's like it's just him like asserting authority. Like, it's so easy because like he's such not like a bad guy most of the time that it's hard to forget that he rules this gang. So I think this is just a reminder to the viewers, like, oh, he's a gang leader. Right. And so like he's also not completely pure. He doesn't want to be like, he doesn't want people overstepping bounds, I guess is what I'm saying. So, all right.
So I was actually mistaken. Like at the end of the last episode, I thought that it showed like the new opening, but it's actually just the new ending. The ending, it's kind of like, if you told me it was an opening, I would believe you. It's, you know, maybe not the splashiest opening, but it's, you know, got a lot more like animation and choreography, you know, that you would sort of expect out of an opening. But it's not. It's the ending. Like, oh, I guess, you know, we see this in shows sometimes. Halfway through the season, they change the ending, but not the opening. But yeah, that's what it, I think since this episode 13, there's just a new ending now, which is pretty good, I think.
Yeah, it was a good ending. And I will agree that I went to go and find that because I was like, oh, the new opening for starting on episode 13. And then I went to look for it and I'm like, oh, there isn't one. We were mistaken about that. But yeah, but then I watched it in full, the new ending. I'm like, yeah, that's all right. It's pretty good. We'll have to like look into those more when it comes closer to award season, think what we think about them then. Okay. Let's talk about the final premiere of the block this week, which is One Piece. One Piece 776, saying goodbye and descending from the elephant, setting out to take back Sanji. Yeah.
That's a pretty good description of the episode.
Yeah, almost. That's pretty much all you need to know.
All right, we're done.
All right, let's go over some things. So first, Momo says that he wants to stay. He wants to stay and try to communicate more with Zunisha.
I mean, I don't really blame him. It's like, hey, this 1,000-year-old elephant thing just spoke to me somehow. What's the deal with that?
What's up with that? Yeah. And Kimina is like, okay, well, here's what we'll do. We're going to split up into four teams. And I wrote them down here. So first there is the Cat Viper team, which is going to go and find that Phoenix guy. I still don't understand. I don't remember or know why that's important, but that's something they need to do, apparently.
Dogstorm. As far as we know, we don't know if anyone's going with Cat Viper. He just said Cat Viper is taking care of that.
Well, they showed like a group of people.
I don't remember.
Like every time they did it, they're like, it's Cat Viper's group. And then they would show like Cat Viper and like, I don't know, five other characters. But I think with Cat Viper's group, it was kind of people we don't know.
Yeah, just a bunch of minks or whatever.
Just minks, I think. And then we saw Dogstorm's group is the group that's going to stay on Zoe, and that's going to include Momonosuke.
Mm-hmm.
Then we've got Luffy's group that's going to go after Sanji, and of course that's Luffy and Chopper and several other people. Yeah, Brooke. Yeah,
and Peckham's.
And Peckham's, yeah, who we see later. And then finally, the last group is Kinemon's group, and they're the ones who are going to go to Wano directly. And it's going to be Kinemon, and it's going to be Kanjuro, it's going to be like Frankie, Robin, et cetera, et cetera.
Usopp. Basically, yeah. Law's entire team.
Yeah. So that's the plan.
I still think it's kind of funny how Law just got roped into all this. Like, yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
taking on. Well, I guess he kind of had a bone to pick with Kaido. Not really, but that's.
Yeah, I wish they would do more with his like motivation here, right?
Yeah, he's with them. So.
Yeah. Meanwhile, we see that Luffy is running to go find Peckham's. He finds Peckham's under a building, and then this is the big reveal of what Peckham's devil fruit is. We see that he has the turtle fruit. Because he can go inside a turtle shell, and that's how he was able to not get die when he got shot by Gang Beji earlier.
Yeah, and he even mentioned that his like turtle shells is like hard as diamond, so it's like basically unbreakable by normal means. So bullets can't get through it. So we imply that's how he survived. Yeah,
he gets mad too because like Luffy doesn't react to that.
Yeah.
He's like, I just told you it's made of diamonds. It's like diamonds. And you didn't say anything. All right. When we come back from the commercial break, Pedro jumps down from the tree as he always does. He's always up in the trees. Jumps down from the tree and he says, I want to go with Luffy.
He mentions, and I'm not entirely sure if we knew this or whatever. He's just like, I'm the only one who can keep tabs on Peckham's or like whatever, something like that. So he's like, because Peckham's is going, I need to be there also. Like, if you would have told me if these two characters were related before, I'd be like, besides being minks, I don't think so. But I guess, he's like, okay, he needs to keep an eye on Peckham's for some reason.
Oh, you know what? I didn't even think of that. They're both like cats, right?
Yeah, like kind of. Oh, yeah, but that musketeer guy whose name I forget, one of Dogstorm's guys, he's got a weird name. I remember, I forget, but he's I should go. It should be us, and then. Cat Viper Cat Viper makes the decision.
Yeah. No, well, it's a bunch of people. Like the nurse wants to go and like a bunch of people want to go. And then
it gets a little bit silly where they're just like, we need to keep an eye on Brooke or whatever they call him, like Mr. Bones or whatever.
Baron or something. Yeah.
And they're just, you know, they just want, you know, to chew him or whatever. And he's like, no, Pedro will go.
Yeah, yeah, it's Cat Viper's like only Pedro can watch over Peckham's.
For some reason.
I didn't put together that they're both cats. That's probably why, right? That's probably the reason, something like that. I mean, I think it's really because, like, as we'll learn later as things go on, like, Pedro's super skilled. Like, we haven't seen him do much, but, like, he's very, very good. Anyway, we cut over and we see that Usopp has made Nami a brand new Climatact. This new Climatact infused some of his like growing plant crap into it so that it can like extend and retract super powerfully.
Yeah, it's like Goku's power pole.
Yeah, so. She gets a new weapon and she kind of like, you know, is like surprised by how powerful it is. And then like he's like, you know, maybe you'll pay me for doing that. And then she does like her Mirage Tempo and like it runs away. That's the joke.
Yeah, pretty silly. I still think it's just kind of funny, even all the way back in Skypiea, that like Usopp's just like, hey, I took those like shells or whatever they were, and I just put them together and made this weather altering stick. Like, you could do that? And then, like, I made it better. Like, sure, I guess Usopp can make really powerful weaponry.
He's always been, I mean, for the record, he's always been like inventing a tinkerer things. Type. Like, yeah.
But this isn't a big criticism. I remember the first time he made that climb attack. It's just like, this is a pretty powerful weapon. He just kind of came up with out of nowhere. Yeah. Here, have this. It can create.
I think it's even weirder now because, like,
oh yeah,
how does it work? It just works.
Don't think about it. Yeah, it's also just kind of like, why is Sanji so strong? He just sort of is. He doesn't even have a devil fruit.
No comment.
I mean, he's like an assassin, I guess, or his parents were. Yeah. Up to this point, he's just like, I'm strong and kick good.
So. Yeah. That's all we've seen. I won't say anything else. Okay. Yeah, but anyway, she's got a new climb attacked. And then everyone meets up at the edge of Zunisha's rear end or whatever, and they're like saying their goodbyes. Like, take care, farewell. Luffy just grabs everybody with his long, stretchy arms and just jumps. That's how they're leaving. And we get a long shot of everyone screaming because they're falling to their deaths into the ocean as they head off for Whole Cake Island. They actually specifically say that, too. That they're going to Whole Cake Island.
Mm-hmm.
Which I don't know if they've ever said that before. Maybe they have.
No, but I don't...
I don't know.
If I had to guess, I would say they hadn't.
Maybe when they first talked to Big Mom when they were in Fishman Island, they might have said Whole Cake Island, maybe. Anyway. The last thing we see at the end of the episode, though, is meanwhile, elsewhere, Vivi. We see Vivi is on a ship, and she's super excited because they're heading out to sea.
But why?
Why, indeed? Know. Well, I think we'll learn that in the next episode. So that is it for episode 776. This is the final episode on Zoe, and now we are off. Literally off of Zoe.
One other very important comment.
Yeah.
Nami has a new outfit.
Oh, I didn't notice. Okay.
Yeah, it's like a white blouse with like a frilly dress.
Well, don't get too attached to that.
No, okay.
Because when they get to the next arc, everyone gets new outfits.
Oh, well, so that's the thing. Like, I know people get new outfits. You know, sometimes Luffy does, sometimes Nami does. She's kind of been in that, like, cocktail dress for a while. So I was kind of thinking, oh, here's her new one. But I guess it's temporary.
Probably temporary. I mean, actually, I don't know how long it lasts. But I mean, I know at some point they all get totally location-specific outfits. Okay. So, yeah, that's pretty typical, though, of One Piece. Every time they go,
I was thinking like this was the new outfit for Nami for this arc, but I guess not.
No. I think they're going to look different soon. So. Okay. All right, and then that is it for One Piece and something up with Vivi.
So when do we hit filler? You've talked about this.
Well, we've got two more episodes of whatever's happening.
Meanwhile stuff.
Oh no! I'm sorry. Three. There are three episodes of this meanwhile stuff, which was. That's what the VVTs is. The VVTs is like three episodes of Elsewhere on the Grand Line. So once we get through those three episodes, then we're going to have three episodes of the full-on anime filler. Just
cool.
Completely non-canon stuff. So, and then we would be into Whole Cake Island. Like I said, I'm really curious to see if we're going to commit.
Yeah, so I wonder how like the season breakdowns are in terms of like,
yeah.
If Toonami is licensing, you know, the TV rights for this from Toei,
I would say the cutoff is six more episodes.
Okay. That, yeah.
I think that's, like I say, I think if we get to the first episode of Whole Cake Island and that airs, then I think they've got that season. But if they air six more episodes and then somehow just drop One Piece, then that would make sense to me. I don't think they're going to do that, but that would be the end of their purchase run. So,
yeah. So we're on episode what? 776?
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, you're right. So according to like the DVDs in Japan, the Whole Cake Island arc or DVD set starts on episode 783. So that's seven episodes from now, right?
Yeah.
So
Yeah.
Presumably. I know sometimes like the airing rights where they start and stop aren't exactly the same, but assuming it's the same as like where the DVD start. Yeah. 783 would be the next arc. So if we get that episode, we're probably good.
Yeah. That's actually a little further than what I said, because if we're on 776 and there's six more.
Yeah, that's right.
Is it right? Okay. I mean, I'm just counting around.
Yeah. Cause that's 777 8 9 81 2. Yeah.
Okay. So you're right. Yes. Okay. Gotcha.
No, that's seven. Right? That's six. Yeah. I'm miscounting. But yeah, 783 is the key number.
So that'll work out. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I think that's going to be the big tell. Again, I think I'm making a mountain out of molehill here. There's been no indication that One Piece is going anywhere. I think that's just going to be a tell.
Just practically speaking, if you're a company like Adult Swim and you have to license this show to air it, then this is, you know, where you'd have to do it.
Right.
So they have to make that agreement and pay whatever, you know, they agree to license this arc and to air it. So they would have to, this confirms that if they air that episode, they would do it or not. But I guess until then, we just have to enjoy Meanwhile and Filler.
Right. Okay. All right. So that's the rundown for this week. Let's talk briefly about flavor alerts.
Play flavor alert.
Potential award nominations.
Anything jumping out to you this week? Crocodile said maybe some. By the way, Crocodile left earlier. I didn't mention that. He did say maybe some stuff from Don to Don, but he's not sure. I don't know. I mean, I think I'm trying to be like realistic about like award nominations being exceptional.
Yeah.
And just because a scene is really good or a character says something really cool, I don't know if it's always a guarantee nomination. It needs to be something exceptional. But I'm open to suggestions.
I don't think there's like this is a good episode, but I'm not sure if anything sticks out as like best moment or best character or voice performance or.
We nominated some stuff last week for Rooster Fighter. I feel pretty good about that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think I have anything this week myself.
Yeah, nothing in Blue Lock for sure. We can maybe, do we have a worst character category? I forget if we got.
We should,
yeah. Yeah, we do. We have Takemichi in there. yeah. I don't know, like some of these Blue Lock characters, maybe we'll see what happens. But.
Yeah, I'm cool with that. I mean, let's watch out and see where this goes, but yeah.
Yeah, nothing in One Piece. Like, it was kind of a transition episode.
Right. It's just the end of an arc. Okay. All right. Well, we tried.
Yeah.
Okay. So that will do it for episode 474. Thanks for being here, Seda.
Yep. No problem.
Thanks, Crocodile, for being here earlier. We should be back again next week for the same lineup. And until then, later.
Later.